Now, let me say at the outset, I've never been a horse tragic. I never grew up around horses. There's no family history around them, just the odd pony ride as a kid. So I've never really understood that intense bond between human and great galloping beast that people sometimes develop. My producer, Pam O'Brien, grew up in England and rode horses obsessively for a while through the countryside. Pam, what exactly was the appeal? Why did you want to spend half your teens galloping through the countryside?
I think this is a very hard question you're asking, because it was all I knew from when I was about 10 to, I don't know, 17 till I discovered boys. But even now, I can remember so clearly this feeling of riding around a beautiful Sussex country lane. I think it was probably even cold, so not even a beautiful sunny day or anything. And I was on my horse, and I just remember thinking, what do people do who don't do this? It was such a realization of pure happiness, and I just couldn't imagine what a life outside that happy horse bubble was.
Now, when Michelle, our colleague, heard you say that you were part of a pony club, she said, oh, I would love to have been part of a pony club. And I said, why? Why is this teenage obsession with horses? Where does that come from? And she said, Richard, she said, it's because you're looking for something to put all this love and affection you have. And it's so easy to give it to a horse, she said. Is that right?
That does make sense. I mean, I had my own horse. I was very lucky to have my own horse. I would spend before school, after school, all weekends with my horse at the riding stables. It didn't matter how mucky the work was, or, you know, how hard it was, or how little sleep I had. Horses are huge beasts, really, and they could crush you in an instant if they wished. So for a beast like that to allow you on his back, to be able to direct him, to be one with him, especially when you're doing something like galloping, and it's a privilege, I suppose. But there's an element of danger about it, because it's unpredictable. You don't know exactly what they're going to do. So I think there is a thrill to it as well.
So it's like it's a creature with an enormous amount of power.
Yes.
And it lends you its power, and you feel grateful and touched by that or something.
I think that's it. And you receive love from that.
What do you mean?
Creature.
How do they express love to you?
The way they greet you, you're coming up to the field, like with my horse, I'd walk up to the fence, he would see me and give a little kind of what they call like a little wicker.
What's a wicker?
I just don't know if I can impersonate it.
Like a little.
Like that? Yes. And then canter up to me and then nuzzle his head into my arm. And you look into their eyes, and the eyes are like beautiful pools. I don't know if you've ever looked into a horse's eyes.
They're black.
Deep brown. And also, I used to lean down and breathe into his nostrils, and he would breathe into my nostrils.
Really? That's so intimate.
Yeah, very intimate. Yes, yes, very intimate.
What was your horse's name?
Easter Bunny. I know, it's not a very majestic name, is it? I wish I could say something really grandiose.
Easter Bunny. Then late last year, I interviewed Pip Courtney, the presenter of Landline on ABC TV. And Pip talked about going with her friend Kathy down to Hobart's 7 Mile Beach with their horses. And this is how she described the exhilaration of that day.
I'd never really opened up, Ned. I'd never really said, let's go 100%, because you're bombing around in the bush. And I think it was the perfect summer day. And Kathy and I said, right, let's see what these old fellas have got. And it was like being in a Ferrari. We went gallop side by side for a little while, and then I just looked over and she said, let him go, let's see what he can do. And I let him go. And I mean, he was about 16'2" hands, so he's quite a big horse, and I'm just touch under 5'3". So I just opened him up, and he was like finding another gear, and then a little bit more and a little bit more. I don't think I'll ever forget what it was like to be on top of a horse that I now had. I couldn't have stopped him if I tried. He was going flat strap, and you can't hear anything except his breath, and it's like a train. And I'm sitting there like a little pimple on top of this massive power horse of muscle, And if he'd stopped at a shied at a piece of seaweed on the beach, I was toast. And it was the most exhilarating moment of my life, going flat out. There's no end. The beach just goes and goes. And it was absolutely exhilarating. And I suppose jockeys get to experience that every day, every week. And I just got it for that little, probably 15 minutes of just, maybe, probably not that long. I can't even remember how long it, but I went until he just ran out of puff.
Today on Conversations, you'll hear from a bunch, or should it be a herd, of different horse tragics. People who've been changed by that bond that they've formed with their horses. You'll hear from a drover, an actor, and a movie stunt woman. Actor Colin Friels has been working with horses for many years. He keeps them on his property. And I spoke to Colin Friels a few years ago and asked him why he was so fascinated by these great beasts.
Oh, don't get me started. I'll
I will get you
I'll
started.
Boy to death.
If you don't mind me.
I've always, since I was a kid, you know, loved them, but never had the opportunity to have great things to do with horses. But
explain to me what it is about horses that really captivates you, what it is that's lovely about them.
I suppose it's not for... there must be some reason that through the ages they've taken on mythical proportions through the millennia, you know.
What do you love about them, though?
What I love about the horse is that's an aesthetic. I don't know. I'm a fairly anxious person, I suppose, but when I'm near a horse, that anxiety goes away, and just the heart rate drops, the breathing gets easier, and you're home. You know, they're an extraordinarily intelligent animal. Their perceptions, their sociability, they're probably the most social animal on earth, you know.
Do they pick up on your emotions?
Oh, instantly. I suspect, now there'll be professionals out there that'll say, what's that idiot talking about? But I find, you go into the yard with a horse, or you meet a horse for the first time, whatever it is in you, that horse has got you within a heartbeat, within a second. It knows you. Backwards, it knows where you're coming from, knows what you're about.
It must do
so
that from
it reveals
the way you
a
move.
Lot of yourself.
So it must do that from the way you move.
The way you move, just what you are, just what you give off. I mean, you move your shoulder a quarter of an inch, that's big language to that horse. You, however you stand, that's massive language to that horse. I can never understand how a horse thinks. I don't know. I can never be a horse, but I can observe all the time. It's body language. I can pester horsemen who are extraordinary horsemen. I can ask them questions, and then I'll go and work the horses myself. So it's the relationship you form. It'll all sound cliched, but it's that wonderful purity of just working with another animal. You and it, you're just there in that moment, which is why for me it's the thing is it totally relates. It's completely synonymous. It's on the same track. With theatre, with what you try to do in the theatre in front of an audience, if you've got a play. You can have a beautiful horse, you can have a temperamental horse, you can have a cranky horse, a phlegmatic horse. The same with a play. You can have a very powerful play that moves sweetly, and you approach it very differently. It requires different things. So over the years for me, they've completely joined in working with horses, working them on the ground, learning about them, working them, riding them on the saddle, bareback, whatever you do, working them at liberty, all sorts of things is the same as body language you need in a play. You move certain ways. The horse sometimes, not your audience, but you've got your audience in the theatre. If there's not an ephemeral connection with the audience, it's a connection you have to be flying like a tornado sometimes, but you've got to have that little atom in your ear that's tuned into the audience, because that's who you're telling the story to. So the older I get, the more subtle it gets, and how fine, almost it's ephemeral. There's nothing you can describe. You can't grab it. It's not there. There's a great old horseman, Tom Roberts, said once in one of his little books about green horses, he said, always remember with how little force can I control my horse. And he was a great old, did remounts for the First World War and all that, and a remarkable old South Australian horseman. And, you know, Australia's full of extraordinary horsemen of the past, and they have wonderful wisdom.
So it's like acting insofar as you have to let your mental chatter sort of go away.
Oh, yeah.
And operate on the subconscious or instinct to a large part.
You have to find that quiet part. Now, there'll be people out there that have to work hard and make a living at starting horses and doing all sorts of things, dealing with cranky stallions or other horses have been abused and all that, and they'll think, what's that idiot talking about? So I come from a very privileged position where I can easily kill myself down in the yards. I'm down there for hours by myself, and there's no surety that I'll be walking back up to the house that night. But that I don't mind that risk. I don't mind getting on something that's off the track and tearing away on it. It's up to me. The horse is balanced, my balanced. But it's how you work a horse. I'm fascinated by the European Enlightenment period of horses. Masters like Pignatelli and Garenier, they were great, extraordinary horsemen of the 16th, 17th century. And the form that they could create, because the horse, of course, was a crucial part of their life, especially if you're working for the court of Louis. They're going to have to be pretty good horses, and these masters come along once every 150 years or something, and you read their writings and what they understood, and it's all quintessentially, it all gets back to nature. They never lost touch with nature, these fellas. And they never lost touch with the fact that the horse... You see, working a horse and riding a horse, if you're doing it right, you're literally in the rhythm of nature. That's the wonderful thing about it.
So if you're reading books on looking after horses that were written in the kind of the Renaissance period, you're a man who's really loving this thing. You're a man who's almost obsessed by it.
I am obsessed. It's a deep passion that I have. You have to do, if you work with horses, I believe, you have to do two things. You have to study and you have to practice. But I don't think you can do one without the other. I believe you have to, just the same as with if I do Mark Rothko or Willie Loman or whatever, I have to study what that's about. I have to find that period. I really do have to study and put myself into it. And then, of course, you get on stage, so that's the practice. And it's the same with the horse. Because what better place to go and get some information from, I think, than that Enlightenment, that European Enlightenment, the French Enlightenment, the British Enlightenment. Extraordinary knowledge was gained in horsemanship in those days.
So obviously you know when you're getting pleasure out of a horse. Can you tell when a horse is pleased with you?
Oh, you want them to like you, yeah.
How do you know?
There's just something, that's the thing, they're not going to say, oh, g'day, how you going? Gee, it's nice to
see you again.
There's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful horseman, a man called Stephen Gladstone. I remember someone saying to him once, do you have to get on, and he's a man of few words sometimes, Stephen, but a master horseman. Master Gladstone is, and I remember he turned to someone once and they said, so are you friends with the horse and all this sort of stuff? And this man just turned around in his understatement, he said, oh yeah, you want him to like you. But it's that he knows, I've seen him work some of the feral horses, and within minutes, that horse loves that man. I don't know how you know it, I just know that horse loves that man. It feels secure. It's found nirvana, it's found heaven in this man. And because this man understands that animal so well, and all the body language and everything that goes with it, because he deeply, intrinsically understands horses, that horse goes, ah, thank God, I'm home. And from there on, the partnership is just a beautiful thing to watch.
What's your opinion of horse racing, then?
The Ottoman Turks had a thing about horse racing. I think William, Prince of Orange, and I think it was the Bayerly Turk. They were in Ireland fighting the Battle of the Boyne, and it finished, and they had a race. And it came down that the Turk said, oh, horse racing, yes, yes, running around a track. And that's what our schoolgirls do after school for pastime, But they couldn't believe that men of civilised bent would sort of do this and think it was anything extraordinary, because how could you torture these yearlings and 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds to run around a track for fat people to get rich on. It's a They're magnificent creatures, thoroughbreds. They are beautiful, beautiful, beautiful creatures. But if I ruled the world, and I never will, I'd ban horse racing tomorrow.
That's Australian actor Colin Friels. Zaylee Bullen is a stuntwoman and an animal trainer. And some years ago, Zaylee was hired to be a Liberty horse trainer on the Steven Spielberg film War Horse. And the star of the film was, of course, a huge horse. And Zaylee needed to humanely make this horse do all sorts of things on cue for the camera. And when Zaylee was on the show some years ago, she told me how her older sister Frida was the first in the family to get a horse.
I would have to have been about 6 or 7 when Frida got her first horse. And of course, I was in love, and I used to follow her around like the biggest pain in the butt you could possibly imagine. Can I have a ride? Can I have a ride? Can I have a ride? And she was very good to me, used to put me on half regularly, but it was never enough. Like, I wanted to be on more than she did, I think.
Can you remember what the attraction was? Like, that's the thing that often little girls have for horses. Can you remember what it was that
yes.
you really loved?
Yes, why? I do. It was a magnificence, beauty.
Mm. Grace.
It was a grace, yes, mm. a sense of freedom. To me, the ultimate dream was being on a horse that was galloping free. And I never imagined I could ever accomplish that dream. It was just an image I used to get in my head. And if ever I felt, you know, people tell you to go to a happy place or whatever, mm. if you're scared, or I used to imagine being on a big valley of green grass on a white horse, just galloping free. No saddle, no bridle, just galloping free. And so I think horses symbolized freedom and safety and, like you say, grace, beauty. Yeah, just all in one.
Who was your first horse?
My very first horse was a beautiful little pony called Casper the White Ghost, which we promptly changed to Peppermint Candy. It was a little flea bitten grey. And, I didn't think that there was a more intense type of love in the world when I was 10 and I was first allowed my first pony.
How did you go riding it to begin with as a little girl?
Oh, no, hopeless.
Hopeless?
Hopeless, yeah, I couldn't ride. But I used to do my best. I didn't have a saddle or bridle for I don't know how long. It seemed like a long time, but...
So you learned it without a saddle or bridle?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I had a rope and I had a halter and I'd hop on her and she'd drop me off at every chance she got.
I was going to say, yeah. How many pins you got in your legs?
Well, I fell off every day.
Every day.
Every single day. Every time I got on her, I would fall off her, but I didn't care and I didn't take it personally. Some of the time I would. Oh, I can't believe you would do that to me. But most of the time I'd just be like, oh, well, I wonder what happened there. And would be like matter of fact and go and climb back on, you know, park her up next to a bucket or a tree or something, fence, and just try and climb back on.
When did you start to do more than just riding a horse?
Well, I was old enough to be going to Pony Club, and I could have been about maybe 12 or 13. We used to ride our horses to Pony Club, and a couple of Spanish guys came to do a vaulting demonstration. Oh, I just thought they were the coolest guys in the whole wide world. You know, they'd jump off, hit the ground, jump back on. It's like, whoa, did you see that? So, you know, of course I tried from that day on.
to jump off the horse and jump back
hit
on while
ground,
it's moving?
Yeah, while it was moving, and we hit the ground and then try and jump back on. Or whatever else it would be, just sitting backwards in the saddle. I used to sit sideways and think I was really cool for some reason. I said, wow, look at me go.
You were brought into the movie War Horse, the Steven Spielberg movie, as the Liberty horse trainer. What is a Liberty horse trainer?
To train an animal at liberty means that you work it from a distance. So you work it without any physical contact. So there's no restraints on it. There's no ropes. There's no one person physically holding it. So if the animal chooses to leave, it can just turn and walk off. So obviously there's a very strong bond and a relationship you need with that animal to be able to communicate with it at a distance. There's a certain amount of discipline and respect and...
It sounds like magic. I mean, do you stand at a distance and you go,
yes.
What, do you gesture something with your hand
yes,
or what?
Yes, we do. We have a wand. We all of us Liberty trains have a magic wand. No, we don't. We don't.
I was believing you for a second.
No, it's just having the ability to communicate on their level.
What are you doing when you're standing
well,
under
you
distance?
Need, I mean, it's not just a matter of doing it then and there on the day. You need training time. You need to be able to bond with that animal. You need a relationship with that animal. You need that animal to be able to turn to you and go, you've got my full attention. What is it that, you know, is the desired reaction right now? For instance, if it's a horse and it wants to stand and eat grass on the grassy hill and that's not the action that the director wants, you need to be able to say, no, you're not doing that. I want you to look left and I want you to paw the ground, then I want you to turn back towards the actor and rear, then turn over your left shoulder and leave screen. So, you know, it might be something like that.
I have to ask, how much coercion has to go into training a horse to be that way? Do you have to beat the horse? Do you
no.
have to? No, there's no cruelty involved in that level of training?
No, I mean, we do this job because we love animals. So we need to form a relationship with that animal and you need to develop the relationship. So it's like starting a child in kindergarten and taking it right through to university. And the more experienced you get, the quicker you can do it. And the reason you can do it faster as you get more experience is because you get into the animal's head quicker and you know, hopefully, you know what they're thinking and what is needed next to get a desired result. So if it's, no, you're not going to eat grass. Remember, I was telling you the story before about, no, pull on its halter. No, you're not eating grass now. Okay, now you can eat the grass. So there's like reward at the end of it. And the reward may be, you know, happy time, play time, throwing the ball for the dog. If the dog says, I want the ball. Well, you can get the ball. But before you get the ball, you've got to go over there, open the fridge, get the can out and take it to the boy on the couch. Then we can play ball.
So what did Spielberg need you to be able to achieve with these horses?
Well, firstly, I need to say that there were actually four Liberty trainers. Yes, I was the person that was called to be the Liberty trainer, but I said the job is too big for one trainer. I certainly can't do it by myself. So, you know, together we all had to get some really complex things going.
Because the horse has got to run through a battle scene, doesn't it?
Yeah.
With explosions?
Yes. Now, conditioning animals to foreign environments is not new to us. It's what we do. You know, there's often got to be, you know, a lion up on a couch or something that is an unnatural environment for it. So that's okay. But to run free and to still do behaviour in a completely foreign and intimidating situation is where you really need strong bonds with your animals. You really need them to trust you. And in fact, if you want it so strong to be so such a safe area for them, such a safe leader of their pack, that if there is any intimidation or if there is any nervousness on their behalf, you want them to turn to you and go, where am I going to be safe? What do I need to do? And then that's when you can reassure them and go, you're doing exactly what you need to be doing. Or, hang on, this horse is starting to get nervous. Everybody cut. I've got to go in and swap horses. This one's had enough for the day. I need to rest it. Or I need to just go up and give him a pat. He's going to be fine. Then I'm going to step back again and we'll be right to go. So just reassure.
Did Spielberg just want you to have the horse run the right way through the right place at the right time?
Yes.
Or was there more than that?
Oh, no, there's far more than that. There's all sorts of things we had to get going. The horse has to get tangled in barbed wire. I know that's a scene that everybody talks about, and that was a very intense scene to film as well. Now, the horse isn't really tangled in barbed wire. It's got fake wire that the special effects department has made. It's got perforations in it, so if the horse actually stood on it, it would actually just tear apart. It is physically encased in this plastic wire, but it is not restrained by the wire at all. So all of that behaviour, the struggling behaviour and stuff you see, is all trained behaviour, and it is all come about through hours and hours and hours of trust and training.
Did Spielberg want to be able to see emotion on the face of the animal?
Yes, he did.
He said that to you?
Yes, I remember one time we were doing called an extreme close-up, and the only thing on the screen was to be the horse's eye. So, you know, you can imagine that if the horse's eye is as big as a TV screen, how close it's going to be, and the horse's head is not to move, clearly. And then he says, now I want the horse to look left. And that wasn't quite as hard as the next one I'm about to describe, because we could actually physically hold the horse's head and hold his eye in shot and then try and get his attention to the left. And, you know, we do it in a gentle and calming way so that all he needs to do is look. He doesn't actually feel like he's got to physically move his head. The next thing I'm about to describe was difficult. The horse had to be completely still and then his left ear had to flick back. So that's all he wanted. He just wanted the slightest show of the horse's attention going somewhere else, then back focused on the actor. So we also had a time when Steven Spielberg wanted the horse to be excited. Well, I mean, he wanted it to show affection, but he was using the word excited. And to me, an excited horse is a rearing horse and a horse with lots of energy and going crazy. And he was like, oh, I want an excited one. So I did all this stuff and he said, no, it's a disaster. It's terrible. It's going completely wrong. I want the horse to be loving and affectionate. I was like, oh, yeah, that's what I thought you meant in the first place. So then I had to slow the horse right down and say, okay, caress him and run your lips over him and show the actor how much you love him. And
And what did Spielberg say to you at the end of the film?
He said to me, when I gave him a hug goodbye, "Zaylee, all of the love that you have put into these animals is on screen. It's on my screen, and it will be there forever."
Broadcast, podcast, and online. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
Today on Conversations, people and their horses, or horse tragics, as Colin Friels puts it. And in this half of the program, we're going back to a time when horses played a much bigger role in Australian life. Back in 2006, I spoke with Bruce Simpson, one of the last pack horse drovers. Bruce was born in 1923 and was brought up on a small selection in outback Queensland. Bruce was a drover for many years, spending 12 hours a day in the saddle. Contract drovers worked in small teams then. They were hired by the vast cattle stations of the north to bring hundreds of bullocks safely to the sale yards and to the feedlots. Bruce and the other drovers worked long, hard days on the stock routes, and they slept in swags on the ground by night. In the evening, it was common for the men to tell each other tales and to recite verses. Bruce found he had a talent for both, and over his life he's published 8 books of poetry and stories and memoirs.
My dad was a top horseman and stockman, and when he came back from the war, he was managing properties in the Blackall area. But in 1923, the year I was born, incidentally, he took up this block. It was virgin country, a block off old Pinnacle Station, west of Mackay. And I was reared there. It was a time when everything was done with horses. The trucks hadn't replaced the teams. There were still bullock teams and horse teams. Light transport was still horse-drawn. There were very few cars about. And, of course, all station work and most farm work was done with horses. It was a time when you rode as a kid. Well, you learnt to ride before you could walk, virtually. And it wasn't hard to see why I gravitated to horse work and stock work with that background and my dad and horses all around me.
Can you paint me a picture of what the property was like?
It was virgin country, a beautiful place, a big flowing creek, clear water, rock holes, swimming holes, fishing holes, and just about every animal you could think of, koalas, possums, sugar gliders, bandicoots, kangaroo rats, wallabies, you name it, it was there. It was a wonderful life for kids, and a wonderful lot of bush tucker there. You could virtually live off the land, and we ran wild, the elder brother and I, on the place. But, of course, we learnt to ride early, and as we got a bit older, we had work to do before we rode to school. And Dad wouldn't give us saddles. He said, "No, you'll learn to ride bareback, because that way you learn to ride the horse rather than the saddle." And it was during the Depression. Things were pretty tough. We never had shoes or boots. We used to get on their horses by reining them up, putting our big toe in the horse's knee and swinging up from there. So it was probably a pretty good basic.
Is that a risky business, getting on a horse that way, Bruce?
Yeah. Well, I remember the first pony I had was a thing called Paddy. He was a cunning little beast. It was only about 2 1/2, I think. I used to ride him round the house, inside the house yard. And, of course, those days it was before Hill's hoists. The family washing was put on a clothesline in the backyard, and when the clothes were pegged out, it was held up by a clothes prop, usually a sapling cut out of the bush. But this Paddy, being a cunning little beast, he soon found that by walking round under the clothesline, he could hang me out to dry, which he did. But it was all good experience.
You had your older brother. I don't suppose there would have been a lot of other kids around. Was it a lonely life a bit, Bruce?
Well, it was never lonely. It was probably we didn't have many mates, but it was never lonely because we had our dogs, we had the bush, and we had the life of Riley, really. Later, when we rode to school, we had a fair bit of work to do. You had to get the horses in for the team of a morning, get the cows in, milk the cows, separate the milk, clean the separator, feed the calves. and then you went to school. And the same when you came home. If you had homework, you did it by hurricane light at night. So it was a pretty tough life, but those days, every farm depended on child labour. No farm could have survived without child labour those days.
Did you have swagmen coming to your door at that time?
During the Depression, we did, yes. And I can remember my dad was a returned bloke, a digger, and he had a lot of compassion for those fellows who'd been in the army. He'd often give them a day's work. And I remember him saying to my mother one lunchtime, he said, this fellow's just too weak to work. You know, I'll give him a few bob and some ration, but you can't ask him to work, he's too weak. So things were pretty grim. But we were never short of tucker. We had our own cattle and made butter and grew our own vegetables. So we were pretty right. Short of money, but never short of tucker. But it was a great background for the work I did. Later I tried my hand at cutting cane, first of all. I left school pretty early. But I wasn't religious, but I'd read somewhere that Cain had killed Abel, and I reckon if I kept cutting cane, it was going to kill me. So I moved on to horsework.
Did you always want to do that, Bruce? Because as a kid, did you hear stories about your dad and other drivers going across the top end?
The stories my dad told, yes. And the fact that there were horsemen in the area, the good horsemen, and you saw them at work and you listened to my dad's stories, so it was fairly natural that I'd gravitate to that.
So when did you go on your first run?
Well, I went out pretty early. I worked in stations all over Queensland, the Gulf and the Channel Country and the Territory. So I worked with some fairly colourful drovers too. Fellas like Looking Glass Joe Dowling and a bloke called Hollands.
Can I ask why he was called Looking Glass?
Well, Joe, I don't know if you remember the old tobacco tins, the old log cabin tobacco tins. On the inside of the lid, they were fairly shiny. And whenever Joe rolled a smoke, he spent some time admiring his reflection in the inner lid of the tobacco tin. So he was called Looking Glass Joe. He was a very smart man, mind you, but a bit vain.
A dapper driver.
And I also worked with the legendary Sam Fuller, who had a buck jump show and a droving plant. And the difference between the two was pretty minimal, I can tell you, because he used the same horses for both at times. So I had a fair grounding in cattle work. I'd worked with bad cattle in scrub country and in the Gulf and the Channel country, and been involved in rushes with other drovers. Now, a rush is what the Yanks call a stampede, but bullocks don't stampede in Australia, they rush.
They rush.
Mm.
Take me through what it was like then on one of those big rides then from, and where did you often go from and to go back to Queensland?
Well, often I used to drive from the East Kimberley stations in the northwest of the Territory.
What, like around Kununurra, around there?
Yeah, Ord River from there.
And what would you find over there? Can you explain what the actual project was? You'd find cattle there?
Well, the thing is, they're all stations there. These stations muster cattle. There's no fattening country out there. It's all what they call store-conditioned bullocks. And those days, there were big bullocks, aged bullocks. Horns on them like reindeer they were, and wild big bullocks. And the station would muster 1,500 or 1,350 of these bullocks, and they would hand them over to the drover. And it was the drover's job then to take them to wherever they wanted them to go. So you had your horse plant of 40 or 50 horses. You employed four men, sometimes five men for a full camp, and away you went. But to take on a job like that, a contract drover, you needed to be fairly versatile and know cattle, and you had to have confidence in your ability. Now, I was only one of many drovers out there. There's nothing special about me. I want to emphasise that. There were a lot of drovers before I was droving and some after I gave it away. But you did need to have confidence in your ability, because if you're a head stockman on a station, you can refer to the manager for advice. The manager in turn can even get on to head office. But when you take delivery of a mob of bullocks, you're very much on your own.
We're talking about a time when there's no roads.
Oh, well, there's stock route roads. They're rough roads.
But not paved roads.
Oh, and there's no bitumen out there. And no fences either.
No fences and not many people at all.
No, there's only scattered stations. You get a Murrinjoy scrub, it's 100-odd miles through, and there's no one in that at all. So the driver's very much on his own. In fact, there's no one above him except God. And drovers are a pretty blasphemous lot. They sometimes speak to God, but never in a way that's likely to get a sympathetic response. So you're on your own, and away you go. And you've got to break your bullocks in, because they're... haven't been handled at all, a lot of these bullocks, and they're big wild fellows. So you've got to break them into the road, you've got to break them into walk straight to feed, to water at certain times, to go on camp.
This is hard labour, isn't it, Bruce?
Well, it's not hard labour, it's hard riding. You're in the saddle probably 12 hours a day and 2 or 3 hours at night at times.
So how do you do that with so many bullock?
Well, you know, once you break cattle in, two or three men can handle 1,500, no trouble. But you have to put them on camp at night because there were no fences or yards. You watched them all the time. And you could gradually push together 1,500 bullocks into an area not much bigger than a housing allotment. And you did that because you could only afford one man on watch unless they were playing up. And he could then ride round and see all over them. And you'd ride round singing or whistling or reciting. You had to make a noise, or the cattle would take fright at you, yourself riding round. So when cattle rushed, they were tightly packed on a camp. They actually exploded off a camp like thunder. For the inexperienced, it was a pretty terrifying experience seeing it.
What could set it off, Bruce?
Well, sometimes a native animal, a possum or a bandicoot might go into the mob, might be a crack of thunder.
Just a possum could set off these thousands and thousands of hooves. That's all it would take.
Bang, they'd explode off the camp. Sometimes a bullock might step on a twig on the camp. At other times, there's actually no reason at all. I've actually been watching a mob when they rushed, and they go that quickly, I don't remember seeing them get up. They're just lying down 1 minute and galloping the next. And they go straight flat, you know, through scrub, over gullies and creeks. And you've got to get to the lead of them on a night horse, and these are special horses, night horses. They've got to be very fast and sure-footed with good night vision and the right temperament. So you gallop to the lead. And as they go, the bullocks string out in a longer mob, the slower ones behind, the faster in the front. So you get to those bullocks in the lead, even on the darkest night, you've got to do that, and you bend them round back on themselves, push them round from the side, get the lead, push them right round back round on themselves in a circle.
And what happens when the circle meets up?
Well, they start going round and round. The rest of the bullocks catch up, and around they're just ringing round there.
Like a cat, like a dog chasing its tail. Mm.
And they gradually, you talk to them, sing out to them, and they gradually steady up, and you've got them then. Now, sometimes you can put them back on the camp, sometimes you can't. Some bullocks won't go back, they just keep coming over the top of you. But your night horses are, you know, they're very special, because as a contract drover, you're paid on your results. The number of bullocks you deliver, full delivery, the condition of the bullocks. So in a rush, not only your life, but your reputation as a drover depends on the ability of your night horse.
So, Bruce, you're saying your whole reputation as a driver stands on these moments.
Well, that's right. If you have a bad smash, you won't get other cattle. So you worked on contract.
What happens if you do lose? Do they just disperse into the countryside?
Well, yeah, sometimes you can get them back, sometimes you can't. You know, I've lost bullocks, but I've managed to track them and get them back. And so I've never made a bad delivery, but other people have.
Bruce, can you tell me a bit what your average day was like?
Well, yeah, you always slept on the ground in light swags. You never slept in beds or anything. So a drover's time's always set at 6 o'clock sundown, so you don't have to change the watches during the night. If you've got a full camp, 2.5 hours watch every night. The contract drover, the boss, does the last watch. About 4 o'clock, he wakes the cook and the horse tailor up. He's the man that looks after your horses. He goes and brings the horses up. And then you wake the blokes up. You're still out with the cattle. They have their breakfast, roll their swag, cut a bit of lunch, saddle their horses and come out. And you start the bullocks off as soon as you can see. And you make use of cattle's natural habits when you're droving.
What are they?
Well, cattle camp overnight in the bush on stations. They get up at daylight and they feed, so that's what you do on the road. You feed them along. On stations about 9 or 10 o'clock, they start walking in for water. So once your bullocks have had a feed, you see them come together, so you you poke them along. And if you're going to water that day, you put them on water that for lunch or whatever, dinner camp. If you're not watering, you dry day sometimes, that is, you don't water at all. So you put them on camp and have a dry dinner camp. And that afternoon, you walk them off, you feed them along, feed them onto your camp, and gradually push them together. And you have your bullocks camp just out from your fire. Behind the fire, you have the tucker pack. I only had packs as a rule, 8 packs. And behind that, you'd have a line of pack saddles and bags, and behind that, your swags, and behind that, where you tied your night horses up.
Now, once you'd come to the end of the day, and you know, you're having your tucker of the evening, was there a bit of storytelling then?
Well, if you weren't too tired, if you weren't getting too big of a battle with your bullocks, there was a lot of yarn. See, there were no wirelesses or radios, as they're called now, out there, no newspapers. You made your own fun. And most fun is based on misfortune of others. So if someone got pelted, or you know, that was usually a great deal of hilarity about that. But you did. We were living a life virtually the same as in the days of Ogilvy and Patterson and Morant, because the way of working cattle that we used was the same. It'd been the same virtually 100 years. Everything was done with horses. So we recited a lot. I wrote a bit of poetry because I thought, well, you know, Morant and Ogilvy wrote about this type of lifestyle. It hasn't changed. I'll do a bit too, which I did. But the territory, when I first went there, it was a funny sort of a place. It was a frontier-type situation. It was developing slowly, but you had the feeling that you were witnessing history being made. The type of blokes that went out there were pretty rough characters. I think that type of area, frontier areas throughout the world, has always attracted the type of bloke. Your adventurers, your ne'er-do-wells, your no-hopers, your remittance men, wife-starvers, and those tough characters that left wherever they came from in a damned hurry and for a particularly good reason. So they're a pretty rough bunch. But that type of bloke is needed in that area during the development process. It was no place for cream puffs out there.
But, of course, in your time you saw that frontier close down to some degree as well. Tell me about how the days of the pack horse drivers came to an end.
Well, in the 60s there was a terrific change. Methods, lifestyle that had been developed over 100 years working cattle were lost in a few short years. Aerial mustering came in, helicopters and fixed-wing aircraft, motorbikes, and transports replaced the drovers. So in a few short years, a whole way of life and a method of working cattle
disappeared. Now, did it break your heart?
It didn't break my heart, but you had to find something else to do, of course. And most bushmen are pretty adaptable. But what's happened now, some stations are starting to go back into horses, and there's been a huge gap in knowledge and experience, so it's a bit like reinventing the wheel. They've got a lot to learn. It's a learning curve again.
Well, Bruce, you've been able to actually preserve so much of this knowledge in your book and in a CD of your poetry as well, which I've got with me now. I'd like to actually play one of your poems from this, if I can.
This is if you like. I'd like to tell you. There's a lot of humour out there. Can I tell you a funny story?
You absolutely can. Go right ahead.
Right, well, you know, you make your own fun, and when bullocks are rushing, you're getting a pretty rough time. But they tell the story of a bloke called Snuffler, who was on the road with a drover whose bullocks were rushing. Every night they were rushing. And Snuffer was a very, very conscientious sort of bloke. Every night, whether he was on watch or not, he was out with the cattle, wheeling them round and steadying them up. And this went on for 10 days or so, and the boss began to rely on Snuffler. And Snuffler started to get jack of this. He said, look, he said, the boss should be doing this. And so this night they camped on a timbered camp. And there's three fairly safe places when the bullocks rush. On a night horse is the best. By the fire, if it's a good big fire, or up a nearby tree. And anyway, Snuffler was getting jack of this with the cattle every night, the boss relying on him. They camped on the timbered camp, and in the middle of the night, bang, away they went, straight past the camp. And the boss and one of the ringers shinned up a nearby tree. And when they got to a safe height, they stopped to listen. They'd hear these bullocks crashing through the scrub. God, boss, the ringer said, the drover, the stockman said, that's a bad rush. Listen to him go. Oh, she'll be right, the boss said. Old Snuffler will be out with him. That's what you think, said a voice from above. Old Snuffler's one limb higher than you bastards.
Former Outback drover Bruce Simpson. And here's Bruce reading that poem. It's called The Murrinjay.
It lies a silent, stagnant swamp, or hung with brooding trees, beside the lonely road that winds out to the Kimberleys. The wild dogs chorus there each night, from scrub on every side, and there in torment and alone some 20 men have died. The wild blacks called it Murrinjay before the white men came, to blaze the road and stock route west that bears its sinister name. A pest-plagued swampland in the wet, a mudhole in the dry, both thirst and fever, deadly foes, then stalked the Murrinjay. They stocked their stations further out and brought their bullocks back, with water 50 miles apart across the dreaded track. Through endless scrub with packhorse plants they travelled day and night. When fever struck, no mortal man could help them in their plight. With brains awhirl they leant upon their mates who rode beside, who nursed them and who buried them in rough graves where they died. The Halls Creek diggings boomed out west, and further every week the rumour of the riches spread, good gold up at the creek. A few made fortunes overnight, with gold the stakes are high, but others staked a final claim beside the Murrinjay. And often troopers on patrol, or drovers passing through, would curse the spot and start upon the task they had to do. The scattered bones were gathered then, the sun-bleached skull was found, another coolie bar was marked beside another mound. They came from many climes and lands, they steered by many stars, their paths converged to meet an end beneath these coolie bars. One was a Swede who'd travelled far, he was of Viking blood. He'd won his spurs in other lands, in blizzard and in flood. The craze for gold was in his veins, he swore he'd beat the track. He reached the Murrinjay at last, with aching legs and back. He stayed a while to drink and rest and wash away the sweat, and by that twisted coolie bar the Swede is resting yet. Two Werbert lads from New South Wales who rode to meet a mob, they never held no fears for them, 'twas just another job. Ah, reckless youth that reckons not what carelessness can cost, they heard the Murrinjay was low, they gambled and they lost. One found his final resting place by way of English pride, for England shipped her wayward sons then when the world was wide. A lone, aloof remittance man, none dared to ask him why, ere fever stilled those guarded lips beside the Murrinjay. They all left family ties somewhere, new hopes and dreams and fears. How many mothers' heads have bowed through waiting down the years. No crosses stand, no railings guard each long neglected plot. Their names unknown, they slumber in 1 acre, God forgot.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler.
abc.net.au/conversations is our website. All of our thousands of podcasts are available for you for free. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.